The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Good Sabbath, everyone. Apologize for the delay. Lots of little details this morning. And in any case, let's go ahead and open up to Genesis 50. Genesis 50 to begin the message this morning. It's kind of afternoon, almost here. Genesis chapter 50. One of the men considered one of the greatest champions of faith in the Bible was the 11th son of Jacob, a man by the name of Joseph. He was the firstborn of Jacob's beloved wife, Rachel, and it's actually believed that he had ginger-colored hair, which is an expression used today to mean a redhead. And this made him, I think, even probably more unique among his kin. Jacob loved Joseph very, very much, and perhaps he showed his favor toward Joseph a little bit too much openly toward others when he gave him a special coat of many colors. And Joseph, he was a wonderful child and young man. We see that even from a youth, he had or exhibited signs of God's favor by having some dreams that were an indication of a destiny that he would have. And those dreams and telling those dreams to his brothers and to his father and to others, this led to a terrible incident of persecution at the hands of his brothers. And so after being sold into slavery, Joseph continued to be led by his passion for God while a slave, a servant in the land of Egypt. And still, even under such circumstances, he remained to be a man of integrity, a man who continued to be dedicated toward the honesty and the goodwill of others and what was in the best interest of other people. And everybody Joseph knew understood that they can entirely trust him. And if they didn't know that at first, when they got to know Joseph, they understood that this was a good and decent man. And so after he came to a position of power in the land of Egypt, he saved that nation, the greatest nation on earth at the time. He saved that entire nation from economic collapse. And then Joseph was allowed to bring his long-lost family into Egypt. And the children of Israel were given some of the choicest land of Egypt, found in the area of Goshen. And there they raised their families, and they flourished. Now, when Jacob, Joseph's father, had come down into Egypt, he was already an old man at that point, and yet he lived another 17 years after settling in the land of Goshen. In Genesis 50, and verse 1, we have the account of Jacob's death. He finally died, and after he had finished commanding his sons and giving them some prophetic information about what their progeny would be like, Joseph fell on his father's face at this point. He wept over him, and he kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. And so the physicians embalmed Israel, much like they did other dignitaries of Egypt. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. The entire nation was mourning the loss of Joseph's father because of what a great man Joseph was, highly respected. Now, when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If I have now found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. And now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and then I will come back.'" And so we see here Joseph still being committed to the government of Egypt. And Pharaoh said, "Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear." And so Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And there they went up with him, both chariots and horsemen. And it was a very great gathering. You can imagine what a great and awesome event this was. And then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a very great and very solemn lamentation. And he observed 7 days of mourning for his father, speaking of Joseph. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning of the threshing floor at Atad, they said, "This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians." And therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. And this is an expression that means mourning of Egypt. So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. His sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron, the Hittite, as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who went up with him to bury his father. And so Joseph and his brothers and other progeny of Israel and many, many Egyptians went up to honor the great man, a patriarch of the faith, Jacob. Even those who did not understand the God of Israel, those people who did not honor the God of Israel even, were involved in honoring Jacob because of Joseph, because of the good and great things that Joseph had done for their nation. And so guilt is something that's hard to let go of. And we see that in the next verses that Joseph's brothers were still feeling guilty about what they had done to Joseph decades prior. They had repented of what they had done to Joseph, but they still were concerned that their brother might have some hostility or a grudge, be holding a grudge against the 11 brothers. Well, 10, I guess. We'll leave Benjamin out. After all, this was a very serious and potentially deadly ordeal that they had put Joseph through. And some of us, maybe, we have experienced something similar in the fact that someone we love may have betrayed us and caused us great emotional pain. But have any of us been betrayed to the point of great physical harm, even potentially losing our life? This is something I think that relatively few people in the world, throughout the world, have experienced, but it is something that Joseph experienced, and it is something that some of us might still experience in life. Christ actually prophesied about the end of the age, and he said in Mark 13 and verses 12 and 13 that brother will betray brother unto death, he said even. Father his child will betray his child. Children will rise up against parents, cause some of them to be put to death, and you, meaning those people who are true believers, people who obey God, who keep his commandments, you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end, this same person shall be saved. And so this is something that happened to Joseph. He remained faithful to his father Jacob, therefore remaining faithful to the statutes, the judgments, the commandments of God. And we have his example, no matter what he experienced, of remaining faithful to God and honest in all things, unto the very end of his life, as we'll see in just a few moments. But his brothers, they continued to feel guilt about what they had done. Perhaps it is that some of them didn't fully repent, that they were sorry that they were caught now, but, you know, some of us have experienced that, where we're sorry when we get in trouble, but are we really sorry for what we had done that was wrong? But these individuals, Joseph's brothers, were concerned that after Jacob's death, that Joseph's, you know, his remembrance of that event, it might be rekindled, and perhaps he would do something about it. And so in verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." And you can see, understand how they might think this, because not only was Jacob gone, but here Joseph had missed out on who knows how many years of the opportunity to spend with his father that he loved so much. And so we don't know the exact age that Joseph was when he was brought down into Egypt, probably a young man, but he probably lost some, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15 years of being able to spend time with his father. But even though Joseph understood, this was actually for good. God desired for this to happen. And so in verse 16, they sent messengers, because of their concern, they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus shall you say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Yes, but now please forgive the trespass of the servants of God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke these words to him. And his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? Who am I to pass judgment on this situation? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. And now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Long time. The 12 brothers, or I should say the 12 tribes here, 12 sons of Jacob, they flourished in the land, this fertile land of Goshen. They became very well known by all. And Joseph remained in service to the Egyptian government there. And he lived, as the scriptures say, they lived to see the third generation of his sons, Ephraim's children. And he remained to be a respected individual, a dignitary in the land of Egypt. And we'll see evidence of that in just a moment. And finally, as it says, at the age of 110, Joseph knew that his life was coming to an end. And after all that he had seen, after all that he had experienced in his life, Joseph never forgot God. And along these same lines, he never forgot God's promise to his forefather, his great-grandfather Abraham. In verse 24, Joseph said to his brethren here, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." And then Joseph, he took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, as was the tradition in Egypt, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt, a coffin much like the ones that the Egyptians would use to mummify or embalm their dignitaries and place in a grave. So the point of this message today is this unusual request here that Joseph had to ask a future generation to break open his tomb, take out his bones, put them in a satchel or a bag or something, and carry them to a far away land and to bury them there. And while we have examples of some people being requested to be buried in a specific place after they died, this is the only example I'm aware of where somebody said, "A long time from now, you're going to dig up my body, dig up my bones, and take them out, and I want you to take them to somewhere else and to be buried someplace else." So Joseph, he was a very wise man. He understood God, and it's my belief that he understood God's plan for mankind and what would happen to those individuals that were faithful to him. And so with the extent of the wisdom that Joseph had, what could be the reason for him making such a strange request? Well, I've talked about this in the past, and it's been a number of years now, and so I thought it would be worth revisiting since we were going through the Exodus these past weeks, and we're going to continue going through that book. When you look at the wording here, this was not simply a request made by Joseph. He actually took an oath. So in other words, this is an order. He's saying, "I'm telling you to do this, and I want you to commit to tell me you are going to do this. at some future point, your children's children's children are going to fulfill this command, if you will. Well, the Bible tells us, as we had read during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that Israel did fulfill their commitment to Joseph, that they did take his bones with them. And we have the historical account, and we can trust it. We understand this is true. But is there actual evidence, is there physical evidence, I should say, that this event actually did happen? That Joseph did leave in Egypt, that all of those things the Bible talks about did occur, and that he died and his body was embalmed, placed in a tomb or a coffin, and later the children of Israel exhumed his bones and took them to another place. Well, there is evidence, and so I'm going to show a brief clip from a documentary that was produced by Tim Mahoney, and it's called Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, and then we'll continue with the sermon.
Tell me, who is Manfred Bietek?
Manfred Bietek is probably one of the greatest archaeologists alive today. And he's dug at one of the most important sites in the Eastern Delta, a city called Avaris, which is in the land of Goshen, which the Bible calls it. And I believe this is the place where Joseph and his brethren lived.
Well, I went to see Manfred Bietek.
Right.
And that's not what he said. He said there's no evidence of this at the time of Ramesses.
Exactly right. Most scholars will say if you look at the city of Ramesses, there are no Asiatics there. There are no Western Asiatics living at that particular city. But dig down a little bit deeper, and you do find a city full of Asiatics.
Yeah, but the Bible says it happened at the time of Ramesses.
Mm-hmm.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that this particular mention of the city of Ramesses, the building of Ramesses, is what we call an anachronism. It's something that's been added into the text later by an editor. Mm-hmm. So what the editor is basically saying is, this is the place where the Israelites built the store city, and we know it today as Ramesses. Well, but in the ancient times, it was called Avaris.
Okay, so the people would know the area, the region.
The people of the Bible would have known where Ramesses was and where, therefore, their ancestors actually built the city.
I also found that the Bible, in the book of Genesis, uses the word Ramesses hundreds of years before Pharaoh Ramesses or his city existed to describe the land where Joseph's family settled. So if the name Ramesses in Genesis does not refer to the time of Pharaoh Ramesses II, then why should the mention of Ramesses in the book of Exodus be any different?
Now this Avaris is the city which lies under the biblical Ramesses, Ramesses of the New Kingdom, Avaris of the Middle Kingdom, the 13th dynasty. It lies underneath the city that's mentioned in the Bible. So when Bietek digs up a huge population of Semitic-speaking peoples with Semitic culture, living in the city of Avaris for several hundred years, and then, at the end of the period, these Semites all leave, depart with their belongings and abandon the city, whatever Manfred says, that to me sounds awfully like the Israelites.
Well, what he told me was that there was no connection.
Well, look at the evidence that you've got here.
Right at the beginning, at the heart of this community, at the end of the 12th dynasty, we see a Syrian house appear.
The Austrians call them Mittelsaal houses. This type of house is found in North Syria, the area where Abraham came from. It's exactly the same style of house you'd expect Jacob to build for himself in Egypt. And we know that the Israelites sought their brides from Haran in that region. They all went back to get their brides from there. So the culture that turns up in Egypt at the end of the 12th dynasty seems to have come from North Syria originally.
So what is the connection with Joseph out of Avaris?
Well, after this house of Jacob, if we can call it that, is built, eventually it's flattened, and on top of it, an Egyptian palace is constructed, Egyptian architecture this time. However, the occupant was not Egyptian.
The palace had courtyards, colonnades, audience chambers. There was even a robing room.
It obviously belonged to some high official of state who was very, very important to that state. Because when somebody gets a palace like this given to them, it means they're being honored for what they've done for the state.
Now, in the garden behind the palace, the archaeologists found 12 main graves with memorial chapels on top of them.
You have 12
we
graves?
We have 12 graves.
And why would that be significant?
Well, think about it. How many sons did Jacob have?
Yeah,
how many tribes were there?
12 tribes.
Exactly. And what's also amazing is the palace had a facade, a portico with 12 pillars. Mm-hmm. So you got 12 sons, 12 tribes, 12 pillars, and 12 tombs.
Interesting.
Yeah. Is that all coincidence?
Now, one of these 12 graves was very special because it was a pyramid tomb. This in itself is extraordinary because only pharaohs and queens had pyramid tombs at this time. Yet the person buried in this tomb was not a king. Even so, he was honored with a king's burial. And inside the chapel of the tomb was a statue. What we know from the statue is that this man had red hair. He had pale yellow skin, which is how Egyptians depict northerners. He had a throw stick across his shoulder, a unique symbol of office made for this Asiatic official living in the land of Goshen. And on the back of his shoulder, we see the faintest remains of paint, colored stripes from a multicolored coat.
And that matches exactly with the story of Joseph in the Bible. The multicolored coat is a gift which shows that he was the favorite of the father. And it almost becomes his insignia, this coat. It's the thing we remember about him most of all.
Do you know of any other statues of a Semite of this kind in Egypt?
There is nothing else like this in the whole of Egyptian history.
Really?
Nothing at all.
David Rohl is not the only one to see a connection with Joseph at Avaris. Mahoney went to see Professor Charles Ayling, an Egyptologist who has also investigated the events of the Exodus and its connection to Egypt.
Would it be unusual for a tomb to have a statue?
No. It's unusual to have one this large. This would be probably twice the size of a normal human being.
What does that tell you when the statue's larger?
That it's a very important person. Now, of course, this is not a pharaoh's tomb or palace, but the man who lived there, you can identify his nationality by looking at the fragments of the statue. Three things: the hairstyle he has, which we often call the mushroom hairstyle, mm-hmm. and then secondly, the weapon he carries over his shoulder called a throw stick, which we would associate with like an Australian boomerang, and then the coloration of the skin. The skin is yellow. All those things indicate that this would have been a Syro-Palestinian.
Dr. Ayling, do you think this is Joseph?
Either it is Joseph, or it's somebody that has a career remarkably the same as Joseph did. It's just an incredible thing to find this at this time period.
The Exodus was a story about the birth of a nation. It was time for Mahoney to go to Israel. This gave him the unique opportunity to meet with Israel's president, Shimon Peres, and hear his perspective about the character of Joseph and his rise from slavery to governing Pharaoh's court.
If you look at the way the story is written, God chose him for a mission.
I read somewhere that Tolstoy said that this is the greatest story ever published in human literature, the story of Joseph and his brother and his going to Egypt. Joseph was the first Jewish advisor on earth, and he advised the most powerful empire in the vicinity. He conquered the heart of everybody he saw, men and women.
With God's help, Joseph was able to save Egypt by warning of a coming calamity. 7 years of plenty would be followed by 7 years of terrible famine. Pharaoh is so impressed that he puts Joseph in charge of preparing for the famine and makes him second in command over the entire country.
He managed to achieve this by foretelling or explaining the dreams of Pharaoh about cattle coming out of the water of the Nile. As first of all, 7 fat cows, and then 7 lean cows come out and devour the fat cows. It's an extraordinary story. But the clue here is that these cows are coming out of the Nile. It's the Nile itself which is the cause of both the plenty and the famine.
If David's interpretation is right, then the regulation of the Nile may have been key in planning for the coming famine.
There's a canal or a waterway that connects the Nile to the Fayum Basin, which is a large lake area, which has the name Bahr Yosef, which means the waterway of Joseph. And this goes back thousands of years, as far as we can tell.
Why do you think that that canal has that name?
Because I think he made it. I think it was under his instructions as vizier of Egypt that that canal was cut. And it was cut to divert half the water from the Nile into the Fayum Basin. You then get back to the situation where the water levels are just right for growing crops.
Can you see it today?
It's still in use today.
And the construction of this water diversion system is dated to the same period as the early settlement at Avaris.
Joseph gathers up all the grain during the 7 years of plenty in Egypt. He gathered as much as the sand of the sea. And then the famine comes to the entire region, and only Egypt has bread. So everyone comes to Joseph for what they need for survival. When their money runs out, they sold their animals. When that ran out, they sold their land, and eventually they sold themselves. So Pharaoh, by the end of the 7 years, owns everything in Egypt.
Mahoney wanted to know if there ever was a time in this era when a dramatic shift of wealth and power occurred between the people of Egypt and the Pharaoh. He went to Pennsylvania to see an archaeologist who spent many years studying the Exodus and the conquest. His name is Dr. Bryant Wood.
When we look at Egyptian history, we find something very significant happened at this exact time. Egypt was divided up into areas called nomes, kind of like districts all over the country. And the leaders of these nomes had tremendous wealth and tremendous power. We get to a point in Egyptian history when suddenly that all changes and all the wealth is concentrated with the Pharaoh. What on earth happened here? If you read the Egyptian history books, there is no explanation for it. They don't know what happened, how it happened. I mean, this was a tremendous social economic change.
Well, what do you think happened?
Well, we have the answer in the Bible, and it's Joseph's famine policy, and he brings the wealth into Pharaoh, and it fits exactly with Egyptian history.
David believes these events occurred during the reigns of two important Middle Kingdom pharaohs.
This key time is during the co-regency between Sennacherib III and his son Amenemhat III. I believe this is the time of the famine, and that Amenemhat was Joseph's pharaoh. Amenemhat is depicted with worry lines. His ears are turned out so that he can listen to the concerns of the people. He's not depicted in the usual bland way that you see in all the other statues of past and future pharaohs. And I think this is an indication that in his time, Egypt was experiencing serious problems. And guess what? He builds his pyramid right next to Bahr Yosef, the waterway of Joseph.
The amount of archaeological evidence matching the first step of arrival in the biblical sequence seemed overwhelming to Mahoney. The Syrian-styled house that appeared in the delta along with a palace fit for royalty, whose occupant was a high Semitic official from the Canaan area who wore a multicolored coat. The waterway of Joseph, contemporary with the rise of Avaris. The end of influence and wealth for the regional governors as the power of Pharaoh reached new heights. Yet these events converged at a time when the statues of the pharaohs were depicted in a unique, careworn way, the telltale signs of a kingdom in distress.
Well, why is it that we've never heard of these finds?
Because in the scheme that's used by scholars to date all these events, they're way too early. They're much too early to be Israelites. I'm basically saying, well, why not call a spade a spade?
At the pyramid tomb of Avaris, excavations revealed one other important piece of evidence.
The crucial clue for me, which says to me that this man with the multicolored coat is Joseph, is found in the story of Exodus. When Joseph is on his deathbed, he tells his brethren that when they leave, they must take his body with them to the promised land. What matches the story even more incredibly is that pyramid tomb was empty when the archaeologists found it. There was nothing in it at all, apart from a few fragments of this smashed statue. There were no bones, there were no mummy beads, no coffin wood, nothing. It was cleaned out.
So it was a grave robber?
Not a grave robber. What grave robber is going to take the bones? Bones are intrinsically of no value whatsoever.
Okay.
Nobody takes the bones. Only people who are treating the body with reverence take the bones. The body was taken out, and all the grave goods were taken out. I think this is the tomb of Joseph, the pyramid tomb of Joseph, honored by Pharaoh with a colossal statue, that when Moses decided to take the people out of Egypt, he made sure he fulfilled that promise of Joseph to take the body out of the tomb and take it to Shechem and bury him in the promised land.
This location, photographed in the 1800s, is where many believe Joseph's bones were finally laid to rest in the ancient town of Shechem in Canaan. The city is known today as Nablus on the West Bank, where this tomb has been at the center of much political and religious tension.
Okay. Is that okay? All right. So in the little clip from that documentary there, we saw that the Shechem, this area, is believed to be, they think they know this is where Joseph's bones ultimately came to rest and are there to this day. We don't know for certain if that's where they are at, but that's what tradition tells us. But I think it was interesting to see that there is a palace, or was a palace, that was uncovered in this area known as Avaris, later called Ramesses, where Joseph's body was buried in a coffin, a tomb. And he was honored by the Egyptians in this way, and then his bones were removed. But again, we get back to the question of why such an unusual request by Joseph. It certainly seems rather odd. Let's go over to Matthew 15 for a moment. Matthew 15. During the last stage of a person's life, psychologists have called this final segment integrity versus despair. And so when it becomes clear that we are going to die, most people anyway, enter a time where they want to be remembered for something, something of value, that they did something positive, a person of integrity, that they had a positive impact on people. And we would all like to be remembered for accomplishing something of value. No, Joseph had certainly accomplished much during his lifetimes, several things of great value. And so he had much to be remembered for. All that he had done for the land of Egypt, all that he had done for his kin, these brothers that became tribes of Israel. And he began to see how those tribes would grow, seeing under the third generation of his own son, Ephraim. And so in this way, we see that Joseph, he was much like a savior to that land, to the people of Egypt, and even to his own family, the children of Israel. So in many ways, Joseph foreshadowed Christ. He was a Christ-like figure in the land of Egypt. Now consider a few examples of this. Joseph was the firstborn son of Rachel. Christ was the firstborn son of Mary. Joseph was raised among his kin, and Joseph's kin should have loved him. They should have treated him respectfully and honored him and respected their father in this way. Well, they didn't. And Christ, well, he was raised among his kin, brethren of Judea, and they should have welcomed him and respected him. But they did not. Instead, like Joseph, he was mocked, he was ridiculed, and persecuted, even to a sentence of death in Christ's case. And Joseph certainly came close to that. Joseph was sent by his father Jacob before he was sold as a slave. He was sent by Jacob to make sure that his brothers were on the right track when they were taking care of Jacob's flock. Well, Christ, he was sent to the religious leaders of Israel to try to get people back on track because they were supposed to be taking care of the Father's flock. And yet they were off track, just like Joseph's brothers. And Christ even said in Matthew 15 and verse 24, he said, when he answered these people and said, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And so we have that similarity there with Joseph. And though he acted in the best interest of his father, Joseph's brothers, they conspired to kill him, just like Christ, who was acting in the best interest of his father, Father God, and yet the religious leaders conspired to kill him. In chapter 27 of Matthew, Joseph's brothers hated him because of their father's favor, and this caused them to be envious of Joseph. And so did the religious leaders of Christ's day. In fact, Matthew wrote about Pilate, that Pontius Pilate understood this. In Matthew 27 and verse 18, it says that he, Pilate, knew that they had handed Christ over because of envy, just as Joseph's brothers did to him. Still, Joseph did not retain any anger against his brothers. He didn't seek revenge upon them for what they had done to him, despite all that he had suffered. And also, Christ would not return hurt for hurt. He taught individuals, actually, to turn the other cheek, and he did this very thing himself, even as he was dying, hanging on a stake, saying, Father, forgive them. And so Christ, we see, he was tempted in all things, just as we are, and Joseph was tempted in many, many things, and yet he remained faithful, just as Christ remained faithful. The Pharaoh, at the time of Joseph, he, after he raised Joseph up and put him in a position of authority, he renamed Joseph, and I'll probably mispronounce this, but he renamed him Zaphnath-Paaneah. And there are several interpretations of this name. It's believed to be of Sumerian origin, and it's believed to mean one or more of the following. One to whom hidden things are revealed, certainly descriptive of Joseph's interpreting dreams, but also, I think, descriptive of Christ revealing hidden things to people. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says that the name means the one who furnishes the nourishment of life. Certainly fitting for Joseph and particularly fitting as a description of Christ. The American Tract Society Bible Dictionary says that the name means Savior of the world. Yeah, bring me a couple of batteries. It looks like the battery dropped. I know somebody's listening anyway. That was a good catch. Thank you. So where was I? Oh, yeah. So Joseph, obviously, he was not the savior of the world. He saved a lot of people, of course, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people. But we know Christ is the savior of the world. But it's interesting that the name has these definitions. Joseph was the instrument God used at that time to save hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives. And the nourishment that Joseph provided was grain and other goods used to make bread and for food in order to sustain a lot of people's physical lives. And on the other hand, we see Christ is called what? The true bread from heaven, represented in the manna, of course, but I think also that can be depicted in this grain that Joseph used to save people's lives. And so Christ will save people in the future from certain death. Christ began his ministry at the age of 30, and Joseph, in chapter 41 of Genesis and verse 46, says that he was 30 years old when he was brought into the court of Pharaoh and raised to a position of power. Look at all of the similarities between these two individuals, and it is not a coincidence that you can see that this is obviously God orchestrating events. And so let's go back to Genesis in chapter 45 this time, Genesis 45. When Joseph met his brothers again after coming to power, after several years of the famine already had started, in Genesis 45 and verse 7, he said to his brothers, he first said that there's going to be five more years of famine in the land, and God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth, and to save your lives by great deliverance. And so it would be at a later time that Christ, on a much greater, a much grander, a more miraculous even scale, Christ will preserve a posterity and save many, many people by great deliverance. Joseph had an amazing life, and I think one of the movies, the Bible movies that have been made, one of my favorites is Joseph, that was made by TNT a long, long time ago. Well, I guess it's not that long. Maybe it's 15 years ago or something like that. It's a really good depiction of the story of Joseph, and I think they do a very good job of vastly sticking to the biblical text. But Joseph, he did not know how much of his life, how much of the events of Egypt would be recorded and would be remembered by future generations. In fact, archaeologists, one of the reasons why they will try to excuse the biblical account of Joseph, because in the hieroglyphic record that is found engraved in the walls of the temples and the pyramids and the buildings in Egypt, there is nothing telling the story of what Joseph had done for Egypt. It was only in recent years that they discovered this area, this compound of a small palace where there was this tomb that was likely Joseph's tomb. But even so, it doesn't tell the event. None of the hieroglyphics tell of the event of what took place. We have to look to the scriptures for that. And there are a few other documents that have been passed down that tell of the event. And so Joseph, he didn't understand that, though. He didn't know what would be left, what would be preserved, what people would remember him for. And so his dying request here was to ask the progeny of Israel to remove his bones, to dig up his coffin, to take his bones out of that mummification, if that's what it was, and to carry his bones far away. And so this seems to be telling us something about Joseph, something that he wanted to pass on, a legacy that he wanted to leave. Not for the Egyptians, but he wanted to leave for the children of Israel. And while much of what he had done throughout his life had an enormously positive effect on many, many people, not just the nation of Egypt, but for all the people of Israel, he didn't want to be remembered, we see, for saving that nation, for saving the Egyptians. He wanted his remains to be connected to something else, not to Egypt, but to another place and in another time. And so he wanted to be memorialized somewhere else, but not just anywhere. He had a particular place in mind. So Joseph, he was a faithful man. He walked with God, figuratively speaking, like Enoch walked with God, Abraham walked with God. Joseph knew that his bones, they had no physical value, as the one scholar had said in the documentary. People didn't value the bones. They were of no value. What could you do with that? And so he understood, I think, that his bones, even though they had no value monetarily, that they could be used for something of value. Even though the bones were of no value to going into the next life, they could be used to inspire people long after Joseph was dead. They could serve as a symbol, therefore, to the children of Israel, to look toward the future, to look toward the promise that God had made with the people of Israel. And so even before the bones were removed, the people would have that passed down to them going, we're going to leave one day. We're going to leave one day. God is going to fulfill his promise. And when we do, we got to remember, take Joseph's bones with us when we go. So his bones could be used to inspire people throughout the time of slavery, the time of bondage, and beyond. And so by asking the children of Israel to take his bones with them, he was telling them, you're going to leave Egypt one day. You're going to leave this place that was filled with sin. And he would therefore leave a profound message for future generations. And it's this: remember what God has done for you in the past. Remember what God has promised that he will do for you in the future. And with that as a continual reminder for those people, it would also be a message understanding, hey, if we want to take part of that promise, if we want to be a part of that covenant and see the fruition of God's promise to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and to Joseph, how should we live? What should we do in preparation for that? It was an enduring message, I think, to keep the commandments. Keep the statutes and the judgments of God. Be an individual of integrity, honest and sincere and faithful all the time. Genesis 17, so Joseph's bones became physical evidence of the moral standards that God expects people to live by. His life was a great example, a wonderful example, and his bones, therefore, leaving that place, becomes a document in themselves, showing people how we should live, reminding people how we should live in anticipation of a future promise from God. And so Joseph was sure that God would keep his promise to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And so he gave enormous hope to everybody in this final request. He told them that not if God takes you from Egypt, bring my bones with you. He says, when God takes you out of Egypt, take my bones with you. It was sure. And it's a message that should resonate with each of us as well, because we also have a promise that we were given by God, that he will choose a certain people to bring out of this world, to become a kingdom, a nation of priests and kings. And it's not a matter of if God will do this, it's a matter of when God will do this. But whether or not we will be a part of that is a matter of if. It's an iffy situation, if you will, because something is required in order to keep the covenant with God, the covenant that you and I have made with him. So the covenant made with the progeny of Abraham is noted here in Genesis 17. It was made with Abraham and his descendants. But it's not a one-sided agreement. There's something that is required by both parties. And verses 5 through, I'm going to read several verses here. Verse 4, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and your descendants after you. And I shall give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, showing that something was required of Abraham and his descendants. You shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, throughout their generations. And this is my covenant, or a sign of my covenant, between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant It isn't the covenant itself. It's a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you, a male child in your generations, he who was born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant, he who was born in your house and he who was bought with your money shall be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So a person that would refuse to bear the sign of the covenant has broken it, therefore, and will be put out from among the people of Israel, or in this case, talking about the children of Abraham, which led to the people of Israel. So this progeny, this covenant was made with the progeny of Abraham, but it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. It continues. It continued down through time, and it continues, it will continue into the future. It's even unto this day a type of that covenant. In Jeremiah 31, you don't have to turn there. I'm going to read it, though, verses 31 through 33. It speaks of the future. It says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Eternal. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Eternal. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." So he's talking about a covenant where the Holy Spirit is given, a covenant where we can have a circumcision, not just in the flesh, but a circumcision of the heart. Speaking of the mind. It also says in Ezekiel 11, verses 19 through 20, "Then I will give them one heart. I will put a new spirit within them and take the stony heart out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh, and they will, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my judgments and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God." Deuteronomy 30, so this is a covenant that God will make with the house of Israel again, and we see that it is much like the covenant of old. Only there are spiritual aspects of this covenant. And it's a covenant that God has made even with people today who commit their lives to Him, to obey God, to live by His commandments. And so we find this within in the pages of the New Testament. But the New Covenant, it's much like the old. It has the same requirements. The same commandments are to be kept. The same moral standards are to be kept. And when God made the covenant with Abraham, a sign between them was circumcision of the flesh, it says. And many say that circumcision is a matter of cleanliness, or can be considered a matter of cleanliness. And perhaps it is to a degree, but it's no coincidence, therefore, that it portrays a circumcision of the heart, because that is a matter of spiritual cleanliness. That actually is the reason for the law of the unclean and the clean, which there are aspects of eating unclean meats that is unhealthy. It's not good for you. But there are a lot of people who eat unclean meats all their life, and they might live to a ripe old age. So we see that there's a principle behind it, so that we may discern between the unclean and the clean. So it's no coincidence that circumcision of the heart is portrayed by circumcision in the flesh, because they both represent putting off works of the flesh that leads to filthiness of the flesh, leading to sin. Deuteronomy 30 in verse 6 spells it out here, even early on. It says that the Lord will carry you, and the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that so that you may live. And so these are terms that we find in the New Testament, actually. These expressions are found in the pages of the New covenant. And they show us that God's covenant is not just for the progeny of Israel alone. It's not a matter of DNA. It's a matter of committing to God. And that's why God said, hey, if you're going to bring in foreigners, they have to be a part, you know, to bear the sign. They have to commit themselves to living by the laws of the land. Otherwise, they will be cut off from the people. They will not have a part in the covenant. And Paul, I think, made this very clear when he wrote in Romans 28, in verses 28 through 29, excuse me, Romans 2, verses 28 through 29, that he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew, meaning what a Jewish person should, how they should behave, who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit. Exodus 12. So this concept is nothing new to most of us. To some, maybe it is, and to those of us who are aware of it, it's a good reminder. When God made a covenant with the people of Israel, he said this in Exodus 12 and verse 48, that when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Eternal, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land. He'll be waked just as if he was, you know, born in the land, just as if he was a physical Israelite. For no uncircumcised person shall eat it. There shall be one law for the native born and for the stranger who dwells among you. And so it is that the covenant he made with Israel was the same covenant that he offered to those who wanted to be a part of the people of Israel. So it is that the mixed multitude that came out with the Israelites, that they would have to bear a mark of the covenant in their flesh if they wanted to remain among the people. And so it is that you and I have been given a similar opportunity to be grafted in to the people of Israel, to be considered an Israelite indeed, an individual who is honest and sincere and faithful to God. And we have an opportunity to do this. Can you imagine that? Being able to make a covenant with God, a contract with God. I mean, the magnitude of this opportunity should not be taken lightly. There are many people who sign contracts for various business deals. There are business deals going on today, even as we speak, both large and small. There are people who will, you know, sign contracts to, make a structure, to do some landscaping. Perhaps they make an agreement to record an album or to publish a book or maybe to cater a wedding. These are all important things to people. Whether it's self-contracting work or pacts to, you know, between nations, there are nations making pacts with one another right now and have been for a long time. And these are a big deal. But they all pale in comparison to making a covenant with God. Making a pact with Iran so that they don't build nuclear weapons is a big deal. But a covenant with God is even bigger. It's even greater. This is serious stuff. It's important. We need to pay attention to it. Could there be anything else more important in our lives than making a covenant with God? Anything? I say there's not. There is nothing more important than making a covenant with God and sticking to that covenant. So understanding the magnitude and the far-reaching effects of this covenant, what manner of person ought we to be in all manner of holiness, of godliness? Yes, something is required of us. And this is the message that Joseph left us through his bones, I believe, the most important thing he could pass on to future generations, that he wanted all of God's people, all who would be called unto God, to know that even though he was committed to making Egypt a better nation, I mean, we have commitments to other people in life. We have a commitment to our employer. We have commitments to our families. And we should live up to those. We should. Even though our commitment to God is even greater. And Joseph, he had enormous success in the land of Egypt. He was a man of great power. He had wealth. He had property. And yet he was still considering himself a stranger in that land. This isn't my land. This isn't my place and time. No. I'm looking toward the future. I'm looking towards something else. And that's what he wanted to relate to us. And so it wasn't his desire to remain attached to the Egyptian society by having his bones remain in that place. He sought another place. He sought a city, if you will, like Abraham did, a city whose builder and maker is God. And that's what he sought, and that's what he wanted his descendants, his kin, his progeny to seek. A city whose builder and maker is God. And so this is the message that he left for them, and he leaves for you and I. He speaks to us from his grave in this way. Now, all of us have invested a lot of time and effort in this world. We've all put in a lot of work. Some of us are still very young, but you're putting in your time to build a life in this world, to pay for a vehicle, to pay a mortgage, to pay your bills, to acquire, you know, knowledge, to have a trade in life, to be able to make a decent living. It's a lot of time and effort we put into these things. And so did Joseph. He put in a lot of time and effort to building a life for his family and for his brothers in the land of Egypt. And still, as much as it might have seemed to be his home, and as much as this world might seem to be our home, it's really not. We are pilgrims in this world. We have to remember that. So like Joseph, we should be determined to find our way out of this current state and remember that we're going to leave one day, hopefully, God willing, if we qualify, we're going to leave one day and do what it takes to make sure that that happens. So consider how much of this world do we really seek to experience, do we really want to be a part of? When Christ is going to return, or as that time approaches, are we even now perhaps looking at the world going, you know, I really want to do this and that. I really want to experience so many other things before Christ returns. Because I've heard people in the church say things like this, that there's so much I'd still like to do before he comes. It's almost as if saying, I hope he doesn't come yet because there's still some things I want to experience. You know, we see people in the world that are moving further and further away from moral decency, particularly in the nation of America. We see seeing this happen. I mean, some of the stories I read in the news every day makes me think that people are losing their minds. What is happening in this country and around the world? And this attitude of straying away from those things that are right and good and just, it has affected the Church of God to a degree. It has. People are letting up and letting down. Brethren are becoming relaxed in their approach to obeying God. Some people think that we don't really have to be as diligent as we did in times past, that, you know, it's God's okay. He's pretty laid back. He knows I have certain desires and needs, and he's okay with a few of these things. Others might think, well, that they can bend the rules. They can kind of make up their own rules about how we should obey God. And this is, I think, like Israel. They cast off restraint. After the death of Jacob, after the death of Joseph, we don't know how long it took, but it didn't seem to be very long till people started giving in to the ways of the society in which they lived. And so God allowed them to go into bondage because of that. And so consider that we are much like Israel in more ways than we want to believe. And ask ourselves, could I be leaning a little too far to the left sometimes? Am I really on track as I could be? Could I be a little more diligent, a little more faithful to God? Seems like there's always room for improvement, no matter how much we do. It seems like I always think, well, there's probably something else. We don't always know it, but when it comes to our attention, don't, you know, scoot it away. Don't sweep it away. Go, maybe I'll get to that later. Because we might run out of time. Eventually, the people of Israel, they ran out of time, and so could we. Exodus 13, years after the Israelites entered Egypt, the children of Israel came in and settled in the land of Goshen. God brought them out with great miracles and wonders. Many likely had forgotten the oath that they or their forefathers had made with Joseph, but there were some who did not forget. And after Pharaoh finally decided to let the people go, in verse 19 of chapter 13, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under a solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. Joshua 24, after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, the children of Israel, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, they eventually began the conquests of Canaan. I went too far. I went to Judges. As they made their way across the plains, through the mountains, as they conquered many cities and they drove out heathen across the land, they renewed their commitment to God. This was something that Joshua wanted them to do. And they laid Joseph's bones to rest. Verse 32, the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem in the plot of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph. And so it is that that image we saw at the end of the documentary might be the very location where Joseph's bones are unto this day. You know, none of us have lived such an amazing life as Joseph did. I don't think any of us have suffered as much hardship as Joseph did, as far as the persecution, becoming a slave, nearly dying at the hands of others. Nonetheless, we are descendants of Jacob. We are descendants of Joseph in this way, and it's not because of DNA, it's because of our commitment to God. And in this way, we have made a covenant with him. And so I think this makes the story of Joseph's bones should be just as meaningful to us as they were or should have been to the people of Israel. And so won't Joseph be pleased to find out when he's resurrected that Israel fulfilled their commitment, that they took his bones out of that place and laid them to rest in Shechem. And even more so, I think, won't he be pleased to know that his bones actually had an effect on people in would have been his future, people in the past, people even to this day, that the story about Joseph and the story of his bones have made a positive impact on us. Not because we're physical progeny of Israel, not because of DNA, but because of the covenant that we have made with God. And so remember our calling. Remember the commitment that we have made to God. And remember Joseph's bones.